Thank you for joining us today. Our goal at the Asia Pacific Wine and Spirit Institute is to promote cultural diversity through wine education. This podcast is for wine enthusiasts, beginners, and anyone who is interested in learning more about wine and those who work in the world of wine and culture. Check out our website, www.abwazi.com, and take one of our 30 online wine and spirit courses available. If you're new to this podcast, please follow the show and subscribe if you enjoyed the content. Welcome to the Abwazi Wine Buzz Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clinton Lee. Today's guest has been the recipient of an enormous amount of accolades and awards internationally and is recognized as one of the most influential wine personalities in the world. But she's a businesswoman and she values creativity, she has determination, and she doesn't like to take no as an answer. Today's guest is a colossus, striding the wine world with class, style, and her qualities of being very precise, hardworking, and a pursuit of relentless research. It gives me a huge honor and enormous pleasure to introduce to you the author, Karen McNeil, of The Wine Bible. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you, Dr. Lee. Great to be here with you.
It's very kind. Now, you know, Karen, I personally have studied your book when I was a student. And as the style that you write in, it's very conversational. Could you tell us a little bit about how and why you decided to write such a huge undertaking, you know, this book, which in my opinion, is a definitive work for any wine student. And as such, it's one of the recommended texts that we have for all our students at the Asia Pacific Wine and Spirit Institute.
Yes, you know, when I began learning about wine myself, really the only books that were available were some of the, you know, the big British wine classics. And in all honesty, I mean, I say this with trepidation because I have so many good friends who are in the British wine trade, but those books were very difficult for a young American to understand. They assumed a familiarity with European geography that most Americans didn't have. You know, I can remember feeling like, okay, Mekong, Merceau, Montigny, are these all in the same place or are they different? And also early on, in fact, a lot of British wine books were written almost in the way that one would write a paper at Oxford. In fact, a great many of the British writers and critics came out of either Oxford or Cambridge. And again, for a young American, then, no longer, but then, a young American trying to learn about wine, it was hard. In some of those books, although correct, were deathly to read. They, you know, I would fall asleep all the time. And I thought, you know, if I ever write a book, I'm not going to write it in that way. And I guess I realized from teaching as well that one of the best ways people learn is if they sense that you're just talking with them, that you're in conversation with them. And that's a little less pedantic of a way of going about wine knowledge than I guess a more academic approach. So my goal with the Wine Bible was certainly to make it an academic book and very well researched, but to tell the story of wine in as if you were seated at my kitchen table, and I was just telling it to you.
You know, your book, it's very different to normal. I don't want to use the word normal, but let's just say different writers at the time, you know, which are more textual. Yours, I found, as you had said, it encompasses more than just names and places and regions. There's an enormous amount of research, which this first book took you over 10 years to write. And one can see it because you encompass an enormous amount of cultural aspects. You know, like I think in Saint-Emilion, the first, I think it was a macaroon, one of the oldest macaroon stores
yes.
there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. And when I visited that area, I specifically made a point of visiting that because of what I read in your book.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think one of the reasons we all love wine is because it is so intimately tied to and reflective of culture and art and religion and philosophy and sociology. And so that's the other thing that didn't make any sense to me. Why strip out all those things from a wine book? I mean, I put them all back in, I feel like, because when you, it's why, by the way, when we taste wines in a country, when we actually go there, those wines taste so good usually, because you are, you know, you're there just thrust into the culture of the place. I remember my editor, when I was writing the second edition, which you just kindly held up, my editor called me at one point and said, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm in Argentina." And she said, "Oh, what are you doing in Argentina?" I said, "Well, right now I'm taking a tango lesson." And she said, "Karen, it's a book about wine." And I said, "You know, I don't think you can understand Argentine Malbec until you understand the tango." And I said it in a funny way. It meant to be funny. But in a way, I actually believe that. I believe that the more you feel the richness of a place's culture, the more the wines make sense within that culture.
Definitively. You're speaking to the converted here, Karen, because, you know, when we developed the courses for the Asia Pacific Wine and Spirit Institute, we were very instrumental and made it a point that there has to be cultural aspects, because if you don't understand the cultural aspect, it's very hard to truly appreciate the wine. Now, you are, I would say, a rare person who has tasted over 100,000 different bottles during your career. You mentioned in one...
Someone had to do it.
Tell us, when you now open a bottle of wine, what is it that, you know, is there a sort of set modality you go through, a method, or is it for the moment?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot lately because, you know, when a lot of wine schools, for example, use either a 20-point system or a tasting grid, I know my own employees, I'm coming to you from our offices here in Napa Valley. My own employees, you know, they taste wine in a very analytical way, structured way. And I've decided to stop doing that. I think that when we taste wine too analytically, that you run the risk of missing a very important part of that wine, which is the emotion of how it makes you feel. And I know from students as well that you can write a note like, you know, medium plus acidity, straw pale color, good length, whatever, and you look back on that note and you have no idea what you thought about the wine. Even weeks later, it's gone. So I've been trying to lately sit with a wine and just feel it in a way. Just imagine what comes to mind. Does this wine seem alive? Does it have a personality? Does it seem to be telling a story of a place or a time, right? Because older wines, of course, tell the story of the time they were born, which is just astounding to think about. And then after a few minutes of that, then I might get, you know, technical and start writing down a more linear kind of note. But I first go looking for that lit from within quality that great wines possess, a sense that they, you know, it's amazing because no other food does this, but grapes transformed into wine can actually seem alive. It's astounding.
Very versatile, natural product that that has been given to us from the heavens. So, you know, you spoke about point system, and often when I'm asked, I said, well, when you're tasting wine, there's various aspects, whether is it for a judging process or whether you are trying to pair a wine or is it just to enjoy with friends? And, you know, recently there was an article that was written in the Meininger's Wine Business International about points, which Lisa Peretti Brown wrote that, you know, there are certain institutions that perhaps are more generous towards their point system and she feels that this has left the worldwide wine audience somewhat disillusioned with the point system. What are your thoughts on that, Karen?
I think Lisa's right. Lisa is a major critic in the world. I'm, of course, not a critic. I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, she, I'm not going to say, but, you know, we all in the wine business know the few people who she's talking about, yes, who do just randomly award, it seems like, high scores in order to get their name out there, because then wineries, you know, make a little tag and they say 93 points according to this person, and that gets, you know, stuck on the bottle. But I, you know, the irony, Dr. Lee, is that if you give a score, and in our newsletter, Wine Speed, I do for one wine every week, I do give a score. But if you give a score, you run the risk that someone doesn't read your what you wrote. And if you're a writer, here you have agonized over just how to describe a wine well, and then given someone a way of not ever needing to read what you've written. It's really illogical if you think about it. But I think scores do provide a quick shorthand for people, and that can be helpful. But turning the binoculars around, for writers, it can be a cop-out. It's much easier to write 92 than to try and really encapsulate what a wine is like in words. It takes a long time. For me to write a really good note is about 45 minutes or an hour. And think how fast it is to just give, you know, 92 and then you're on to the next wine. So
I can truly understand the descriptive powers. You know, you once described a Sauvignon Blanc, I think from Napa, as high heels and a tattoo somewhere.
Yeah, I remember that wine.
Tell us about that wine.
Well, you know, you can, there are lots of metaphors. As we know, wine is wine descriptions are metaphorical. They're not literal. And I know people get, they just arch their eyes when you say, you know, this wine is like Lady Gaga or something. People are like, oh my God, come on. But the truth is that those kinds of descriptions do cause you to remember a wine. And we are all, as wine tasters, left only in the world of metaphor because wine is not its own inherent language. An example that I often give is comparing wine to food. You know, food is its own inherent language. So if you say to somebody, here's a strawberry, what does it taste like? They taste it. They say it tastes like a strawberry. Great. It is a strawberry. It tastes like a strawberry. We call that strawberry-ness. And we're all in agreement. But if you say, here's a Vermentino, what does it taste like? And the person says, it tastes like Vermentino. It's not helpful, right? Because wine is not its own inherent language. So we must use metaphor. And even if that metaphor seems to you a little outrageous, like a woman dancing in stiletto high heels with a certain tattoo, even if it seems outrageous, it's still to some extent metaphorically helpful. And it's all we have. So yeah, I can get kind of out there on some descriptions.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. I mean, because it sort of sets the scene, you know, accentuates certain points. You know, I'd like to come back to your book, The Wine Bible. The first edition took just over 10 years. Your second has years, and now you're onto your third edition. And I myself am excited because I do appreciate and study ancient history. So that's something I'd like to perhaps let the audience know, that your third edition of the book has this spectacular and eagerly looked and sought after when it hits the shelves on the ancient world. Could you share some of that perspective, please, Karen?
Yeah, you know, it is very difficult to do research on wine in the ancient world, in part because anthropologists think about time differently. And I wound up making for myself this huge timeline just to understand what was happening in countries that no longer exist relative to other countries. For example, the earliest known evidence now of wine is in China. And it goes back about 9,000 years ago, about 1,000 years before evidence in the what we call the Transcaucasus, which is today Armenia, Azerbaijan, Western Turkey, and a little bit of Iraq. So, you know, it's fascinating, but it's difficult to write about because you have to wonder to yourself, well, when was it wine really, right? Because in the very beginning, it was probably, I mean, alcohol has never not been with us. Fruits themselves will begin fermenting. And so early man for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years was able to stumble upon somewhere a fruit that had already begun fermenting. But when the evidence of actual intentional winemaking begins is hard to figure out. What scientists essentially look for are evidences of tartaric acid, which only grapes and a few other fruits have. For example, the earliest Chinese wine would have been made from a grain and either grapes or possibly hawthorn berries, which also have tartaric acid. So it's fascinating to read about, but it's difficult research because not everything is quite parallel. And the other fascinating thing, as you know, is that the earliest evidence of wine making, you have to consider that along with the development of domesticating grapes. Domesticating grapes actually came much later than just the evidence that, oh, you would intentionally begin to collect grapes, crush them with the intent of making some kind of an alcoholic beverage. It's fascinating though, and I loved writing that chapter. And it's really fun to see how, you know, a lot of books have been written lately on the importance of alcohol historically as a part of our collective evolution as humans. You know, we evolved genetically to be able to metabolize alcohol more than most other primates do, but we're not the best at it. There are other animals that metabolize lots of alcohol and have lots of fun out there too. That's
true. I'm really excited to looking forward to see and hopefully holding a copy of your third edition in my hands. And for the audience and students worldwide, having, you know, being a scholar myself and reading so many different books about wine, I think that this book that's going to come out from Karen certainly will be one that you want to have on your shelf. And we both love teaching, Karen, whether it's to an individual or to groups or what advice would you offer aspiring wine students, aficionados, about the importance of understanding and learning about the cultures of the world when you learn about wine?
Yeah, you know, I'm always surprised when people go to wine tastings and don't have their, in a sense, their eyes wide open of what is happening around them, watching even something as simple as watching how people taste in another culture, watching every little element. I mean, my staff goes wild with me because I become a sensor for everything that is happening around the table or in the cellar when we're tasting wine. In order to pick up on those cultural ideas, you have to, it seems to me, be thoughtfully aware of everything around the wine, not just the wine itself. I mean, for example, I'm thinking about, take something kind of mundane like acidity. We all know that acidity is important. And everybody knows that if you go to Germany and go to the Mosel, you're going to taste wines that are high in acidity. But after really tasting with a lot of German winemakers, I realized that acidity isn't one thing to them. They think about acidity in a whole different way than we do here in the States. We just say it's either there or it's not, that there's a lot or there's a little. But for them, they have all kinds of qualities of acidity. And just from listening to them, I began to see, oh my goodness, this is very different. There's kind of fingernails on the chalkboard acidity. There's shattering glass acidity. There's really cheap acidity, kind of like you would find in a powdered sweet drink, like Tang acidity. So I think just being aware and keeping your eyes open for all these little, they can seem like small things, but they become part of the richness of how we culturally think of wine.
Yeah, I mean, when you were talking to me a few minutes ago about your journey to Argentina and you were taking a tango lesson, immediately the image of you clicking your heels, you know, with the ankles, you know, coming up, that sort of was the image conjured in my mind. And certainly when I was in Argentina, I was thinking of the gauchos, you know, and the boleros, and I think the message is open your eyes, be open, don't be fixated and have these very rigid parameters, because you lose so much. Now, classically, you know, many educators, when they suggest pairings for wine and food, it's been based solely on the sort of European palate and style of eating food, which is now a highly debated topic. Mm. You know, cuisines, like I often, you know, tell my students, I said, okay, you're in India, they don't really eat beef, but now you have a Barolo or you have a Napa cab. So cuisines like Indian, Chinese, Japanese, other cuisines were never really considered in the mainstream. What are your thoughts now on the changing views? Because it's a new generation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on the one hand, pardon me. On the one hand, cuisines that we now enjoy that were not historically necessarily associated with wine, it can work one of two ways, right? The very best thing that happened to Mosel Riesling is Southeast Asian cuisine.
Yes.
Once people realized, oh, wow, this is kind of an interesting idea. But, you know, I guess I would say that I come to food and wine pairing with a little reluctance. I think it's much more important to match wine to mood than it is to food. And you know, of course, there are terrible things you could do, right? You could have a bite of wasabi and a beautiful Grand Cru Burgundy and goodbye Burgundy, because you're not going to be able to taste a thing after that. So there are big principles, I think. But it's also so important to satisfy your mood as well as choose food that you think is going to work. So I'm not very rigid about food and wine pairing.
Again, one could be open.
Yeah. And, you know, you could have a glass of champagne before you had who knows what, your Cantonese meal, and then tea for the rest of the experience. It's morning here, so I'm drinking my tea.
It's wonderful. So, you know, I am, you know, right now the world has changed from when you first wrote your book. There's been different movements. You know, we hear about BIPOC, we hear about really a huge ruffle in what there was, say, 10, 15 years ago. But, you know, In Napa Valley, certainly, and in many places, there's a very large rising Latina population in terms of, certainly there are women, Latina women in the wine industry. And they are significantly large, but what they are actually able to do in terms of opportunity, how do you think one can harness their power, their inventiveness? Because would you say that the Latino grouping is still not on the mainstream radar?
Oh, absolutely, it is not. You know, I don't. If you go to a tasting in San Francisco, mm-hmm. chances are there are never any Latina women there. I don't know of any Latina wine writers, And I think there are only one or two Latina women who have been through the Oenology and Viticulture School at UC Davis. Mm-hmm. I know that when I was writing the second edition, there were none. There are two Latina women in Napa Valley who are assistant winemakers, but most of the Latina women in the wine industry here in Napa Valley anyway, and I think it's true for all of California, are actually in the fields. And this is a very new phenomenon that UC Davis is studying, because Latina women often now are the foremen for picking crews. Uh-huh. They're, and I know many wineries here who love having Latina women as heads of viticultural teams. They're very dependable. They're very smart. They know a lot about viticulture, usually self-taught. Yeah. So I think, Latino men is a different Latino men. That's a different story. Lots of Latino men have gone through UC Davis, lots of winemakers, lots of heads of viticultural companies. But I think Latina women is the last wave that has really not yet taken firm hold in the wine industry, sadly.
Yeah, I think there needs to be perhaps more awareness, not only for Latina women, but women on a broader platform. Now, talking about that, you wrote in an article on November the 6th, 2020, in your My Take column about the blistering New York Times expose, which involved the sexual harassment of women involving the Court of Master Sommeliers in America. And there are those who feel more could be done to enhance, protect, and promote women. What are your thoughts, Karen?
Yes, it's, the wine industry has come a long way, and it's better than it used to be. When I started 30 years ago, I was almost always the only woman in the room. The opportunities for women in the business are greater, but the issues of how women are treated, and certainly the whole inappropriate sexual behavior toward women in the industry, is something that we've only touched the tip of the iceberg there. It's true that I think 8 sommeliers, male sommeliers, were let go, or what word do I want here? They were forced to give up their to give up their credential. Uh-huh. But again, there are a lot more than just 8 men out there who have behaved inappropriately. Part of the problem, though, is, and I don't know how you get around this problem. Part of the problem is that, at least historically, much of what we all did was at night with alcohol. You're in a restaurant, you're drinking alcohol with other people. And as we all know, the best part of wine is that it makes you feel closer to people. It makes you feel, there's such good communal spirit. So when someone hugs you at the end of the evening, at what point is that hug just too much of a hug, right? You'd Yes. think you would know exactly. And certainly you sometimes do know exactly, but every now and then there's a gray area there. And so I think for young women, they really have to have their radar up, because it's pretty easy in situations like that to have that hug that lasts just a little too long and is not exactly right. And it often starts there. So I think, women who are not in industries where alcohol is part of the industry, the behavioral lines are really clear. first of all, you don't hug anybody. There was no communal thing yes. that you're talking about, right? So it's hard.
It is hard because physiologically, you know, when we sort of nose the wine, you know, it goes olfactory system, you know, and then it goes, takes us through to our limbic system, which, as you said, that sort of governs our emotions and wanting to be convivial. So it's not easy. So I think those are wise words that many of our audience, I think, should take heed and definitely consider. Now, you know, the world has changed. There's new countries now that are producing wines, which 10 years ago would be unheard of. And you've had the experience of enjoying yak this, yak that, and yak everything in the Himalayas. And, you know, prior to COVID, I was able to travel the length and breadth of many of the Chinese vineyards. Tell us about your experience with that Himalayan and the yak and what you saw there, Karen.
This was the last wine trip I went on before COVID became known to, you know, the world, to all of us. And it was just phenomenal. I went to visit Aoyun in the Tibetan Autonomous Region. And the winery is at about 8,000 feet in the Himalayas, but you have to go up to about 12,000 feet to drive back in. And talk about culture shock. Oh my goodness. The idea that Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy, which owns Aoyun, would start a winery in a place where there's barely a road in. When they started, there was no running water. There were no suppliers of bottles, capsules, anything that you would need to make wine, tanks, none of that. And maybe somewhat most surprising of all, you know, work orders would come out of France in French. They'd be translated into English. From English, they'd be translated into Mandarin. And from Mandarin, they'd be translated into one of nine different Tibetan dialects spoken in just that one area. And so, you know, it was just astounding to see that they could actually make a real go of it. The wine was delicious. But all kinds of things, you know, the air is different at 8,000 feet. The luminosity is different. And so you're right, though, that the world of wine is in part so exciting because it used to be, you know, 100 years ago, if you asked anyone, are all the great terroirs of the world known? People would say, yes, of course they are. They're all known. We know exactly where they are. They're in Burgundy and they're in Bordeaux. And there are a couple in Tuscany and a couple in Piedmont, and that's it. But now we know that many of the greatest terroirs of the world may yet to be discovered. I mean, China itself offers an enormous possibility.
I was truly surprised myself when I saw the size and the magnitude. And I think mostly was the technology, how advanced they are. You know, you've used that phrase that we've yet to find out about the highest and the best and perhaps terroir that yet to be discovered. And I'm sure you've been asked the question, what's the best wine that you've tried, Karen? And when I'm asked, I tend to answer and say, well, I've yet to try it.
Yes.
You know, there's always going to be another wine out there. Now, you know, staying on the China aspect, China is a Goliath when it now comes to purchasing power of wine. And it's a definite rising wine consumer and to an extent, a wine producing country. In your opinion, do you believe winemakers have started to alter, international winemakers have started to alter and align their styles to this growing market segment? So they can sell more.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question because there's, for the greatest of wines, there's a limit to what you can do. I mean, yes, you could make wine a little lighter in body or a little fuller in body by letting the grapes get more or less ripe. And you could, with certain varieties like Chardonnay, you can use a lot of technique. But, you know, many of the winemakers who I talk to are, when you ask them about, you know, aligning what they make to market preferences, they may admit to trying to do that once or twice. But in the end, they give up and they make, like a great chef, they make it for themselves. They make the wine for themselves. And you can see how one would come to that conclusion because agriculture and viticulture is so slow moving. And trends, market trends, are much faster moving that eventually it just becomes impossible to keep, you know, turning the gerbil wheel of trying to keep up with market trends. So I don't know that that happened. Lots of people think that happens a lot among the great wines. I don't know. And it's also true that, you know, a country as large as China does not have one style of wine that it likes. It's not one place. It's a lot of places, China. I went to China for the first time in 1979. And that was the first year that China was open to the West. You had to go, I went for 7 weeks, 3 weeks in mainland China, 2 weeks in Hong Kong, and 2 weeks in Taipei. And mainland China in 1979 was a very different place.
Oh, yes. Very different. I recall when I first went, I was riding a bicycle, you know, in Tiananmen. And very different. I mean, it's vast. It's a totally different landscape.
Karen, and even then, it was not one place. It, you know, it's a very complicated and complex country with all kinds of different, you know, different paths of language and food and culture. And so I'm always reluctant to, in fact, when people say, what do you think about Chinese wine? I want to say, well, are we talking about Ningxia or what? Where are we talking about here? Right.
Absolutely. Now, Karen, anticipation. When is your book coming out, the third edition, please?
It's coming out October 25th. And we're working. I have the pages here right in front of me. I was working on before you called, just editing these big architectural, they look like page layouts. But yes, it will come out October 25th. And this one only has taken me 4 years to write. So I'm getting so fast.
Now, where can we pre-order?
Yes, I think you'll be able to pre-order it on Amazon, but I don't know that question just yet. But we will certainly have many of the, we will have a stack of the first few copies available at KarenMacNeil.com or on my digital newsletter, WineSpeed. Those two sites will also offer the Wine Bible, the next one. And it's all in color. It's bigger. I'm really excited. I was excited for one and two, but number three is really the best.
Well, I'm sure it will be truly a masterpiece because I called your first piece a fine piece of art, but this will be a masterpiece, I'm sure. And So please line me up. I'd like to get one. And if I could get it autographed, that would really make me so happy.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Karen, you are an endless fascination, a tour de force. For me, it's been a personal honor and a huge privilege to have this time with you. And I thank you very much for being our guest and for sharing your insight. You've often described yourself as an introvert, but I think the world is happy that we see the extrovert in you. And we wish you the very best with the upcoming book. And audience, this is a book you have to get, because if it's anything like the first and the second, this is the masterpiece. Thank you very much, Karen.
My pleasure, Dr. Lee. Thank you.
You've been listening to Wine Buzz Podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please leave a review or share it with a friend. Abwazi is an online wine and spirit institution dedicated to promoting culture and diversity through the world of education. If you're looking to get started, we have a free online course that we are giving out to all our listeners. For more information, head to abwazi.com. That's APWASI.com.